This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello, everyone, and once again, welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Indeed, this is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, joined, as usual, by my entry mate, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. We are together once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios for another special edition of this program. And every single week, we tell you, every week, we get the chance to hear some of the stories that really make this sport go and the stories behind the stories. And that's the case here tonight. And JT, really looking forward to the program. And this show, man, it has just taken on a life of its own. And every week you and I sit here as first and foremost racing fans and go, wow, that was really cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic to put a voice with the name in the program or talk to young guys and gals that are coming up in our business. And So my favorite shows are the assistant trainer shows, because you get the you get the scoop, the real Hollywood story, so to speak, behind what goes on at the barn. And we've got that tonight, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, before we introduce our special guest that is going to be with us for the next hour, let's welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219 and XM 206. And, of course, all of you tuning in worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Now, tonight's guest grew up in the heart of the bluegrass here in Lexington, Kentucky, and he grew up as the son of a Hall of Fame trainer. Does that sound familiar? Well, it should, because a few weeks ago we visited with Riley Mott, the son of Hall of Famer Bill Mott, on this very same show. Tonight we have the privilege of visiting with the 26-year-old Reeve McGahey. I should say 27-year-old, just turned 27 a couple of months ago. The 27-year-old Reeve McGahey, who again is the son of Hall of Famer Shug McGahey. Reeve, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You knew I was going to mess that up, right? You told me before we went on air you turned 27 back in June. I had it in my head you were 26.
Yeah, exactly. I'm
sorry. Well, good to have you on board, man. Looking forward to hearing your story and the story of what it's like to grow up as Shug McGahey, or with Shug McGahey as your father. You now work alongside him as his assistant. Safe to say that, you know, you're learning from one of the best.
Yeah, no, it's been a good experience so far. Lucky to have the opportunity.
You know, your dad is often described as being old school. So what does that make you?
I guess the son of old school. I don't know.
You know, your dad, you got some big shoes to fill here, and I'm sure at the barn too, but your dad was one of my favorite guests we ever had on Trainer Talk. And, you know, he took us through some incredible stories, and every once in a while I go back and listen to the podcast of that interview just because it was so awesome.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully I can live up to half of it then.
What's it like being raised by a Hall of Fame trainer?
It was fun. It was always nice to have access to a lot of things a lot of people don't have access as far as the races and the horses go. So that was always exciting, getting into the Breeders' Cup, participate in it, a lot of the bigger races.
Yeah, it's like growing up with a built-in backstage pass, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When did you decide that maybe the family business was going to be for you?
Pretty much as soon as I was old enough to kind of have an idea of what I wanted to do. I always liked the races and the barn and the horses and grew up around it. So, and then when I was younger, I liked the bet. So I think maybe once I cashed my first ticket, that's what kind of made it something that I really wanted to do all the time.
Who'd you cash your first ticket on?
I can't remember.
What? Everybody remembers their first winner.
One that I remember that I cashed one that paid $2 across the board that paid $20 on a horse in the Sword Dancer, but I can't remember what the horse was. Jose Santos rode it. I remember that.
Was it your dad's horse?
No, it wasn't.
He beat his dad's horse.
Those trainer sons, you know, my son, he I ran a horse for him one day. The horse finished third, and he comes back. He goes, I think I'm going to give that horse to Shoemaker.
You know, Reeve, it's interesting. You mentioned $2 across the board and then being hooked after cashing your first ticket. And I've always said that as soon as you cash that one, you're hooked for life. My first experience at the racetrack that I remember when I went there and bet for the first time was $2 across the board on a horse by the name of Easy Goer in the Traverse Stakes back in 1989. That ring a bell?
Yeah. I was just a couple months old, but I've seen the replay.
Oh, I love that.
All right, get off my show. You're making me feel old now.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what kind of trainer your dad is. What kind of father is he?
I mean, he was always, everything was pretty good. We never, that's a good question. I mean, he was everything we wanted, we always got. He was always the easiest one. But I grew up in Lexington for the most part with my mom, and then when we'd have vacations from school, any sort of break from school or anything, then we'd always, me and my brother would always come up here. So it was always fun, especially for me to come and be around the races and stuff like that and get to follow him around really for a week or so, a couple weeks at a time.
You mentioned your brother, Chip, and, you know, he chose a different path in our sport. What was the dynamic? Was it always like that? Was he more into other things than actually hanging around the barn?
Yeah, I was always the one that wanted to go with my mom to the barn and do things like that, and Chip was always one that was complaining about it. But it's funny because as we got older, then he started liking a lot more, and now he loves what he's doing now. And I would never would have guessed when we were teenagers that he would be doing anything in the racing industry, but that all kind of changed as he went through college.
Wow. What did you think Chip might end up doing?
Something with business or politics, something like that. I think he graduated with a political science degree, but I don't think he really knew what he wanted to do either until he got done with school. And then once he started, he did the America's Best Racing thing. And I think once he started doing that, he kind of had an idea that he wanted to work, have something to do with the races, you know, more of a management position.
Yeah, he's now working as a sales associate at Keeneland with the Keeneland Sales. So he is involved in the sport, but as Jude alluded to, in a very different fashion from what you're involved with it on the training side of things. Did Chip ever give training a try or no?
No, he never worked on the backside or anything. I think he mentioned maybe wanting to walk hot summer or something for my dad, but that never really materialized, and he never really entertained the idea.
He probably doesn't like getting out of bed early.
And your mom, Mary Jane, also working in racing in some respect. She works at the Keeneland shop, right?
She did for a while. She's not anymore. She's fully retired now. But she worked in the Keeneland gift shop for, I guess, almost 2 years.
Visiting with trainer Reeve McGahey, the assistant trainer to Hall of Famer Shug McGahey. Yeah, and that, if you couldn't tell, that is his father. And being raised by a Hall of Famer, certainly different. And Reeve, I told you that we talked to Riley Mott a few weeks ago on this program, and he described his father as being his best friend. Would you say that's a fair statement when you look back on your relationship with your dad?
Yeah, I think so. We've always shared a lot of the similar interests, and we've always gotten along really well. And so I'd say we've always had a pretty close relationship.
What makes him such a good trainer?
I think just his patience with all the horses. He doesn't try to make something out of them that they're not at certain times. And I think he's lucky to have good owners that allow him to do that. And so so each horse can get the individual needs. And he's very good at getting them fit without and keeping them sound at the same time. So I think that pays a lot of dividends too.
It is a luxury having clients that let you do what you do, but I think one of the things that I've found about your father is his honesty, and he's very upfront with everybody and tells them, you know, the truth about their horses. I think that's a big factor.
No, I think it is, too. It makes it a lot easier for him to talk to the owners because they know what's going on, and they don't think that he's trying to pull anything over their eyes. So they know when he calls them and tells them that a horse need some time off, he's doing it for the best interest of the horse.
Reeve, when you answered that question, you mentioned the word patience. And so often when I ask that particular question, trainers will say, well, what makes me good is my patience. And you said the same thing about your dad. Why is patience so important for a horse trainer?
Well, I think each horse develops their own rate. And especially when you get the two-year-olds in, 1 week one might look like the best two-year-old, 1 week the next might look like the best two-year-old. And then you get to the first of the year, they are constantly changing. I think some horses, if you rush them early on, then you might not have a three-year-old anymore. He does a good job of knowing when to push on them and when not to, and which horses are just going to take a little longer to develop.
Is there a horse or a story that stands out to you where maybe your dad was a little extra patient with a horse and it paid off in the right direction?
Well, I mean, I was a little younger, but obviously Pleasant Home was a very late developing filly. I know that they were on the fence about whether to run her in the Breeders' Cup or not, and obviously that paid off. But she was a big, tall, crooked filly, and maybe if he tried to push on her too early, then she might not have ever made it around to be a four-year-old. So I'd say probably her that I can remember.
Your dad trains a lot for breeders, and do you think that has an influence on his long-term views?
Yeah, I think so, because a lot of these horses, they all have pretty nice, fancy pedigrees, but they're also what you get when they're born is what you get. He's not going to the sale and picking out the prettiest horse to buy to train the most correct or anything like that. So you have to take your hand and do the best you can with what you have. And he's lucky to have the horses he has, but also he's able to take advantage of giving them the proper training they need.
Reeve, so how does the dynamic work? Are you typically alongside your dad in the same places every day, or does he rely on you to be at a different track where he has maybe a second string or whatever it might be, and you're kind of running the show there? How does all that come together?
Well, he has his main assistant, Robbie Medina. He's whenever the barn's kind of separated, he goes to Payson, and then my dad and I go to Gulfstream. But since we've been at Belmont, we're all kind of in the same spot right now. And then like when we shipped to Keeneland, I went to Keeneland, and then so I guess I kind of travel around. But when he has a second string stationed off somewhere, then Robbie's with him, and then I stay with him.
You know, that's a question I get from a lot of racing fans that maybe aren't in the sport. They see trainers like your dad, or even on a larger scale like Todd Pletcher and Steve Asmussen, that have these massive stables. And they say, how on earth do they keep up with all these horses in all these different places? How do you do it?
I think just having good help and good people around you. He's very fortunate. He's had a lot of people that are here that have worked here for as long as I was born, 20 or 30 years. So they all know the system and what he expects, and it just makes it a lot easier for everybody.
When we were talking to Riley Mott a few weeks ago, he was talking about his dad's adversity to technology and how he's a pencil and paper guy. Have you included some iPads or anything like that in your organization?
No, we're still pretty much pencil and paper. But my dad, he's pretty technological savvy. He's pretty savvy. He had an iPhone before I ever did, and he can do pretty much anything he wants on the iPhone and the iPad. So. But everything for us is still pretty much pad and paper.
And he texts.
Yeah, he texts a lot.
Yeah, I've always been very impressed with your dad. He's one of those people that when I first started getting into this side of the business years ago, I had a chance to get a chance to spend some time with your dad. And, you know, he's always that type of person that no matter how busy he is, he might not do it right away, but he's going to get back to you. And that, to me, is something that, you know, I always really respected.
Yeah, no, I think he's very good that way. And I think with everybody, I think he tries to accommodate everyone, and he appreciates the fact that people I want to talk to him. So even if he can't do it right away, he tries to make the time to be able to fit everything in.
All right, so before you were working with your dad, you spent some time with a couple of other trainers. Tell me about that.
Well, when I first started actually working every day on the racetrack, I started working for Owen Hardy. He had assistants at the time, a Keeneland guy named Brian Ainge, who was kind of a family friend. So I started working summers for them and then full-time in the winter. So I think I worked 4 summers for them, and then from about a 5-month period of every day with them from February to July, and then they left to go to Saratoga, and I didn't want to go, so I went and started working for my uncle, Charlie Lopresti, and I spent almost 5 years with him.
Why wouldn't you want to go to Saratoga?
I was just done with school, and I was getting ready to start UK, so all my friends were there, so I just wanted to stay home and work.
Very sensible of you. plus, you got to hang around Wise Dan a little bit, huh?
Yeah, that was pretty fortunate. It was good timing.
Did you work directly with Wise Dan?
Yeah, I was with him pretty much every day for those 5 years.
Wow. I've always said he's such a special horse, such a determined horse. He had that will to win. How would you describe Wise Dan?
I think you nailed it pretty much. He was just a racehorse. He loved to run, and he'd run through a wall if he had to.
How incredible were those comebacks that he kept making throughout his career?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was stressful, but he was a tough horse, and that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a racehorse. That's where he was happiest, was on the racetrack. So luckily he was an amazing healer, and I mean, his determination got him home a lot of times.
So all the stories that we hear about him are true. We got it right from you. You were there pretty much every minute of the day with him.
Yeah, I'd say everything you hear is pretty true. I mean, he went through a lot, but he was tough.
Yeah, he did go through a lot, and there were so many times in his career that you said, okay, there's no way that he comes back from this particular injury, or there's no way that he can win off of this type of a layoff, but yet he continued to do it each and every time. Was there ever a time, Reeve, where you said, man, I just don't know if the old boy's got it in him one more time?
not really. I mean, I had confidence. Sometimes it took him longer than others, but he was very well taken care of, so I guess when he came back from the colic surgery, it took him a while to get fully back to himself. But I'd say about two, three weeks before the Bernard Baruch, the light seemed to switch, and he started training like a monster again.
You know, I'm so glad you brought up the colic surgery part of his story, because oftentimes in this game, the negative stories are the ones that get the headlines, and we don't hear about all the positive behind-the-scenes things that go on. Put us in your shoes. When Wise Dan colics, and it was kind of touch and go for a while, describe what that's like as an assistant trainer, being around him and being so close to him. What's that like? Take me behind the scenes with you.
Well, obviously everybody in the barn is nervous. So anytime you have to lay a horse down and do surgery, you're a little scared. But, I mean, the main thing, we were hoping just to make sure he'd come out of it all right and be fine living wise. When the thought of him really being a racehorse again wasn't really in our minds, but luckily when they did the surgery, they didn't really actually have to cut anything, so his recovery was a whole lot easier, and he was back to himself pretty quick. So I mean, it was a pretty stressful couple of hours, but once he was up and everything looked to be good, it was a huge relief.
You mentioned Charlie Lopresti's your uncle, Shug McGahey's your dad. What training styles do they have that are different?
They're similar in a lot of ways, but I guess they're a little different just because Charlie, he has a smaller stable, obviously, so you see a lot of the same horses. You see him around for 4 or 5 years, and it's different in the way that it's run, I guess. But as far as the training itself, it's pretty similar.
All right, so what are the similarities then between a guy like Charlie Lopresti and your dad?
I think they both try to take their time with their horses, and they're not in any sort of rush. Charlie, he turns them out for the winter, though. And my dad, not exactly the same, but it's pretty much the same thing. And the better ones, they're going to get a break at some point in the winter. So, I mean, it's obviously different because we're in Florida for the winter, and Charlie stays in Kentucky. So, but there's a lot of similarities between the two of them.
It all comes back to patience, and that same word that keeps coming up almost every single week here on Trainer Talk. It's patience. JT, I figured it out. I'm going to go into horse training, and I'm just going to be patient.
Yeah.
I'm going to be patient, and I'm going to be in the Hall of Fame.
You better own your own horses, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you do,
or
you get all of Shook's clients, you're in big trouble, because it seems nowadays like owners want to win all the time, and you know, the emphasis is on winning first out and all of that. It's so against the old school that the way I was brought up in the business, and obviously how Reeve was brought up in the business.
Reeve, does that put more pressure on the operation, knowing that, you know, trainers really care about that win percentage, maybe more than ever?
Yeah, you know, there's statistics for everything now, so obviously we don't have a high percentage rate winning first time out, for him, I don't think so as much, but maybe for somebody in a running more of a public stable that's trying to advertise themselves more, than there might be a little more pressure, because new owners are going to look and see your percentage, and they're going to look at your percentage versus somebody else's percentage, and you're constantly getting compared to somebody else.
Yeah, we were talking to Richard Mandela before the Breeders' Cup last year, and you know, his win percentage first time out is pretty dismal, but it didn't always go that way. When he was younger, he was winning a very high percentage of first time starts, and I talked to him about that, and he said now that he's established, he doesn't need to make a name for himself, and so he can kind of do what he wants to do. But in those days, you know, he was operating a public stable, and he had kids to feed and stuff, so it was more important that he win first time out to attract customers. And I think that's probably a very similar story to your father's.
Yeah, I think so. People like to see horses win first time out, and they like two-year-olds, and they want to be a part of the Triple Crown races. So I guess that would probably put you in a position where you're going to be a lot harder on them early on. So they probably will run a lot better first time out, but you might not have as much the sixth time they come around the run.
Talking with Reeve McGahey, assistant trainer to his father, Hall of Famer Shug McGahey, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, Reeve, I'm going to put you on the spot. Pick one thing that you learned from Owen Hardy, one thing you learned from Charlie Lopresti, and one thing you've learned from your dad that's going to make you a good trainer someday.
Well, Owen came out of California, so I saw a lot. That was probably a different style of training than I saw from my dad and Charlie. And when I was there, we were lucky. They had a lot of good two-year-olds. They had Desert Party and all of the Wizards. So I saw a lot about what goes into getting the two-year-olds ready to run first time out and run well. Charlie, I learned a lot about horsemanship. He's a very good horseman on the ground and on top of him. And for my dad, I learned a lot about management and just observing the horses and keeping an eye on them, just all the little things that go into figuring out how they're doing and when they're ready to run and where they need to run.
I love the point you brought up about Owen and training in California and the style being a little bit different than what we see on the East Coast. Describe how it's different from what we see here in this part of the country.
The horses, I mean, obviously you see the times of the works and everything like that. When they work, they work. But so that's a little different, but works for different things, work for different people. So.
All right, Jude, you trained...
A little more aggressive style of training.
Yeah, Jude, you trained horses for 20 years in California. Is there a difference in the way that horses are trained out west as opposed to here?
Yeah, I think so. I think Bob Baffert kind of changed the way horses were trained. You know, everybody would see his fast works, and they were getting beat by him all the time. So owners kind of put the pressure on trainers to work their horses faster, even though it probably wasn't the right thing to do. I mean, Bob Baffert seems to be able to get away with 111, 3/4, and, you know, 58 and change, 5/8. First of all, you got to have a horse that can do that. I never had the luxury of too many of those. But, it is a lot different. The emphasis is on early speed.
She doesn't have a tattoo. She doesn't need one.
And you see that. When you come back, when horses from the West Coast ship east, they're a lot faster early.
Right, right. Reeve, I love it, man. You're working as you're doing the show, man. That's huge. You heard him say she doesn't have a tattoo, she doesn't need one. I think he's talking about a horse.
He's in New York, you never know.
Well, it never stops, and that's one thing about being a horse trainer. It is 24/7, 365 days a year. Is that right, Reeve?
Yeah, there aren't too many days off around here.
Where are you now? Are you at the barn?
Yes, I'm at the barn at Belmont.
So you're trying to work and keep Shug's operation going, keep him in the Hall of Fame, while you're doing the show with us.
No, I'm not having to do too much. Robbie's under control, but somebody asked me a question. Philly in the first time today. So.
Reeve McGahee.
You don't need a tattoo for the first time.
Reeve McGahee here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Reeve, stay with us. We're going to get to a short break. When we come back, we'll spend a little time talking about some of those memories you have of some of the great horses that you've been around, not just Wise Dan, but some of the ones that your dad has trained as well. We'll do that next as Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRN.
This November, nearly 5,000 horses will be offered at breeding stock sales in Lexington, Kentucky. Fasig Tipton has your shortlist. No less than 25 Grade 1 winners or producers, 59 graded stakes winners or producers, 50 selected weanlings, a remarkable 83% black type earners or producers, all in one spectacular evening. One book, one session, one focus. Quality on every page. The world's premier breeding stock event, the November sale at Fasig Tipton.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saiyan Ross and Maya, what if it ain't to the class?
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
Maryland Breds are your formula for success. Be part of a breeding program in a state which offers competitive purses, 30% breeder bonuses, 30% owner bonuses, and year-round racing backed by state legislators creating pro-breeding and racing legislation, all supported by a working cooperative between the racetracks, horsemen, and breeders. It's time to own a Maryland Bred. Better stallions, better mares. Maryland Breds. Learn more at MarylandThoroughbred.com.
Hey everyone, Mike Penna here to let you know that great purses, world-class amenities, and an extended racing season are just a few of the reasons why you should race your horse at Woodbine. Woodbine Racetrack offers a premier experience to all friends of the horse racing community and is committed to innovation. Playing host to over 130 live racing days in 2016 and 2017, with an average of over $500,000 offered in purses daily. That's right, the meet starts in the spring and concludes in December. You'll get access to world-class trainers, a modern backstretch, great training surfaces, and so much more. So why not share in the profit by racing at Woodbine? To start your racing journey, visit woodbineentertainment.com/due north.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Orb is now beginning to fly down the wide outside, and so too is My Loot. They're racing down towards the final furlong, Normandy Invasion. But here is Orb on the outside. Orb and Joel Rosario take the lead with a 16th of a mile to go in the Kentucky Derby. Orb is out in front. Jarvis War is absolutely flying. In fact, it's Golden Soul, but it is Orb to win the Derby. Orb wins the Derby. Golden Soul in second, Revolutionary, and then Normandy Invasion, My Loot and Oxbow. But it was Orb for Shud McGee and Joel Rosario who won Derby 139.
Mark Johnson, the then voice of Churchill Downs, bringing them home in the 139th Kentucky Derby. That was May 4th, 2013, the lone Derby victory on the resume of Hall of Famer Shug McGahee, and we are visiting with his son, Reeve McGahee, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Welcome back to the program. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. If you missed any portion of the program, head back over to horseracingradio.net after we finish up here tonight and check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Good call on the rejoin clip there, JT. Special moment for the McGahee barn.
Yeah, Lee and I conspired to do that. wasn't a really difficult choice, I didn't think.
No, a good choice. Reeve, how about for you? You listen to that call, you think back on that day in 2013. What goes through your mind?
It was obviously a really exciting day. My dad, it was a big day for my dad to win the Derby, and I'd been a weight on his shoulders for a while. Exciting day for me, too. Besides him, because Wise Dan won the race right before that. He's the Woodford Reserve. He's supposed to run against Point of Entry, which kind of was a little nerve-wracking, but Point of Entry scratched because of the rain. So that was an exciting couple hours for me.
Well, you like to cash tickets. You must have left there with plenty of money in your pockets.
Yeah, I'm still a little frustrated over that because I didn't have Revolutionary on the bottom of my try. I had Normandy Invasion. So I did all that work to get Golden Soul in second, 50-1, and didn't have Revolutionary behind him.
That's terrible, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I feel for you. That's not good. But hey, what the heck? Your dad won the Derby and you guys won the Woodford Reserve, so that's the nice consolation prize.
Yeah, no, it was an exciting day. Probably one I won't repeat.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. How about for you? Do you ever think about when the time might be right to go out on your own?
Thought about it a little bit, but I'm in no rush. Enjoying doing what I'm doing, so whenever the right opportunity comes up and my dad and everybody else around me says they think it's a good idea, then that's when I'll start thinking about it.
Yeah, how much do you and your dad, you know, talk about that, or do you talk about it very much now?
No, I don't think we've ever discussed it, to be honest.
So if somebody came to you and said, hey, Reeve, I want you to train for me. I think you do a great job. Would the first phone call you make or the first person you talk to be your dad?
Yeah, I think so. Him or my mom.
Yeah. Why would you go to your mom first?
I don't know. I have a pretty close relationship with my mom, so I think they'd be the first two calls for sure.
You know, that's a great point, too, that we don't often talk about this on this program, but the wives of trainers, and your mom and your dad have been together a long time, the wives of trainers and how much they mean to that operation and their support means to that operation. How much does your mom mean to your dad's success?
Well, my parents divorced when I was three. So, but she was with my dad a lot when they were first getting started, and obviously she worked for him and rode a lot of good horses for him. So I grew up with her in Lexington, and then always came up to see him whenever we had a break from school and stuff like that. So, I mean, I think she had a major impact on his career when he was getting going.
So, I told you that his parents have been married a long time. Told you.
I trust both their opinions. So.
See, I told you that. I told you they've been married a long time, didn't I?
Yeah. I don't know where you pulled that one out, but you got some bad Wikipedia
information. That was some bad information right there, Reed.
No, that's all right.
No, but you're right. I mean, that support means a lot. It means a lot to you, too, as a child of a Hall of Fame trainer, or any trainer for that matter, to have the support of both parents behind you.
Yeah, no, exactly. I wouldn't want to make any sort of a major move without both of their support, so it would make it a lot less stressful for me if I knew. I know they would both support me in whatever I decided I wanted to do, so that makes it a lot easier too.
Well, your mom used to gallop for your dad, and you know, am I right about that?
Yes, she did.
I'm a little scared now to make any statements after the last situation.
No,
but yeah, I just deleted all the notes for the show, by the way.
But she knows the business, which I think, you know, any trainer that has been married knows that if your partner knows the business, it really is a big help. And it's got to be a big help to you that your mother understands, you know, horse racing and what's involved and the commitment that's involved as she participated in it herself.
Yeah, exactly. And she, even when we were growing up, she trained on her own for a while. So, I mean, that's the way me and my brother grew up, is going to the barn before school and going to the barn after school. And then I always wanted to go with her to the races. So I spent a lot of time going to all the racetracks around Kentucky, Turfway for the winters and Ellis in the summers and Kentucky Downs. Then it was Dueling Grounds, but in River Bounds, all. So I've been about everywhere around Kentucky.
Reeve, do you have a favorite horse that you've been around that your dad has trained?
Yes, I just started working for him in December. So, I mean, Ironic is probably my favorite horse I've been around, just because he's the first one that I've been around on a daily basis and worked around. But I was always a big fan of Point of Entry. Watching him run was always exciting.
Yeah, Point of Entry is so spectacular. What makes Ironicus so good?
He has an unbelievable turn of foot. I haven't really been around a horse that can run a final quarter like him. He's a very intelligent horse, and he's another one he just likes his job. So it's fun with a horse like that he knows just enjoys doing what he's doing.
He's had a little bit of tough luck. His recent race, he just fell like one stride short of winning the Shadwell Turf Mile, and he just seems to fire every time. And he's a horse that I think you guys have done such a great job with, because I see lots of gaps in his training, and there seems to be a plan behind, you know, not running him too frequently and how, you know, he'll run off a layoff and then he'll improve his speed figures like 5 or 6 points the next time he runs, and then he gets a break again. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, he's been a little unfortunate soundness-wise. He puts a lot into his training, a lot into his races. So I think that's why he's able to run so well fresh, because he doesn't typically always need a race, because he puts a lot into his gallops and all of his breezes. We were really excited to run him in the Shadwell, and he ran really well. So we're disappointed he got beat, but we weren't disappointed in the effort by any means. And we expect him to take another step forward in the Breeders' Cup. But he trained extremely well going in the Shadwell, and he seems to come out of it just as well, if not better. So I think just because he puts a lot into everything he does, that he's able to run as well as he does fresh, and he puts a lot into his races, so they typically not hard on him, but he puts a big effort into everything he does.
You got another horse that's running now that I think you guys have done a great job with, and she's kind of an overachiever, Onus. Talk about her a minute.
Well, yeah, she's very talented. especially when she gets on a firm turf course. She's going to get bred this spring, but she's run some really, really good races, and she's run a few races that left you scratching your head, but when she was on her day, she was very, very good.
Talking with trainer Reeve McGahey here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayzeh Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Reeve, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. You were going to say something else about her?
No, just that she's a nice filly. She's a big, pretty filly. I think she'll make a really nice broodmare.
Are there certain characteristics or qualities that all good horses seem to possess?
Yeah, I think they all need to have a certain level of intelligence about them. It seems like every good horse that was a little bit better than just being a good horse was just seemed to be smarter, I guess, and they took everything in stride a lot better than some horses that are equally as talented, but they just can't get out of their own way sometimes. So I think, like with Wise Dan, whenever we would ship him anywhere, it was where some horses it might stress him shipping up to New York or to Canada, where he would take a couple laps around the barn, go in the stall, and just go to eating hay like he'd been there his whole life. So I think things like that make it a whole lot easier on separate the really good horses from your average good horse.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, how do you know that a horse is smart? And when you've been around them a lot, it's kind of a laughable question. But what would you say to that?
I think just their demeanor. I mean, they don't always have just the way they handle everything you throw at them, and the way they handle people around them, and just, I mean, we ask a lot of them. Between going to the races and shipping and all that stuff, and you can tell the horses that just it doesn't bother them, doesn't faze them, and some of them it knocks them out for a week. But I think basically just the way they handle everything, the certain level class to them.
Reeve, a lot of people have told us on this program that you can pretty much tell if a horse has that it factor relatively quickly once you get them into your care. Could you go back even to the time that they're yearlings, if you're looking at them at a sale or on the farm, and say, you know what, there's something about this horse that just stands out to me. I think they could be special.
Maybe. I don't know. There's a lot of yearlings that people bought that they all thought were pretty special that didn't pan out. So, I mean, some horses, that they exude a certain class level. Whether that'll make them a good racehorse, who knows. But I think you can see, I mean, obviously you're not around them every day at a sale or anything like that, but a lot of horses will have a presence to them, seems like, and it's just kind of something you pick up on or you don't pick up on.
Talk about,
not everyone will pick it up on the same horse.
Talk about point of entry. He looks like he could be a fantastic stallion. He's one of the best looking horses I ever saw. Talk about him a little bit.
Yeah, I wasn't around him on a daily basis, but he's a big, beautiful horse. He's obviously extremely talented. He was fast and he could carry it a long ways. And I know my dad told me multiple times that he thinks if he would have been able to stay sound, that he might have been the best horse he ever trained. So, that's a pretty good endorsement for him. So, I think he will be a good stallion. I think he could run on the dirt if he had to, so I don't think the dirt will really be an issue with his offspring either.
Yeah, well, having your dad say that it might be the best horse he ever trained is certainly one heck of an endorsement, and point of entry very, very special on the racetrack. And you're right, things going in the right direction now with his new career at stud over at Edina Springs as well. Reeve McGahey, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayzeh Tipton. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the program, head over to horseracingradio.net and download the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They're available for you at horseracingradio.net. Reeve, any other horses that really stand out to you and you say, man, this is one that for whatever reason I'm never going to forget?
I think, working for Charlie, we had Successful Dan and Twirler were there while I was there, and they were very exciting. Both very, very nice horses to be around, do everything around. So those two will always stick with me. When I worked for Owen, we had a horse named Ronaldo the Wizard, and I was pretty green as far as working on the racetrack. And I remember they told me one day, they said, you're going to Churchill and you, by yourself, and you're going to school him, and then he's going to run the next day. So I was a little nervous about all that. But so he'll always kind of stick with me because that was my first kind of experience doing anything on my own. So they just sent me up to Churchill, and I took him over there and schooled him and did everything with him. And so that was exciting. Being that I was pretty young, but I always kind of remember him, and then looking up a few years later, and he won the race in Dubai, and turned out to be a pretty nice horse.
Were you there that day?
I was not in Dubai, no. I've never been.
How much would you like to go?
I'm not in any rush to get there, to be honest.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, Reed McGahee has been to a lot of places, and he's been there with a lot of good horses. If you couldn't tell by listening to this program here tonight, he has certainly learned from some of the best, including his father, Hall of Famer Shug McGahee. One thing you brought up earlier, Reed, was the fact that you watch trainers who knew how to get, like a guy like Owen, two-year-olds ready to run. How do you do that? What's the key to getting a two-year-old ready to fire early in their career?
I think it just, a lot of it takes the right horse, but you got to know when you can be aggressive with him. And he did a really good job of that. That summer that I was there, we had Desert Party, him, Ronaldo the Wizard, another horse named Coronet of the Baron. That he was second in a couple of grade ones out in, at Del Mar as a two-year-old. And they trained and he did a good job of getting ready, and they all fired first time out, and they were all really nice two-year-olds.
Of all the tracks that you've been to, what's your favorite?
Keeneland's home. I love going to Saratoga. Honest stuff, my favorite place that I've been, at least just to ship in and run, was Santa Anita. I really enjoyed a couple times I've been out there.
You know, that's interesting too, Reed, because with Breeders' Cup coming up here in, well, just over a week, a lot of people will say, okay, it's on the West Coast again, Santa Anita hosting it for a record number of years now. It's difficult for the East Coast horses to go west and be successful. Do you believe in that?
I believe in it a little bit. I think it is, because right now, obviously, the temperature's changing. It's starting to cool off. And then we'll go out there, and it's going to be in the 80s. And I think the climate change, it can't, some horses it affects and some horses it doesn't, but it's a different style of racetrack, different style of turf course. So I do believe there is a little, just like a lot of times it's hard for the California horses to come east, I think sometimes it's harder for the East Coast horses to go west.
Yeah, it can be a struggle sometimes, and just, getting them acclimated and organized, and the main thing is to get them into the light. I have a friend who's the world's foremost authority on jet lag in horses, and light is the factor. So get them out, get Ironicus outside as much as possible.
Yeah, we'll work on that.
Do you alter your schedule knowing that you have a horse that's an East Coast based horse, you're going to go out west for a race like, let's say, the Breeders' Cup? Do you say, I need to get this horse there early and let them acclimate because of the fact that the climate and the track is so much different?
I've always heard you either go out really early or you go out as late as you can. So we're going to go out as late as we can and just try to keep them at home as long as we can. And I think you just do whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah,
whatever you're confident in.
The two schools of thought, go out really early or go out as late as you can. Why so much of a difference in those two ways of thinking?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess you figure if you go out earlier, then you have time to get acclimated to the track, get acclimated to the weather, just really get immersed in where you are. Or you go out late and hopefully there's just not an, it's such a quick change that you don't have enough time to really for your body to get out of whack or have to get adjusted to the surface or anything. But we're running on the grass, so it's not like we need to be out there working on the dirt or anything like that.
Yeah, shipping grass horses seems to be a lot easier in general because of that, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's obviously every turf course is different, but it's not like we can go out there and gallop every day on the turf course and breeze on the turf course. So he's comfortable here, so I'll stay at Belmont as long as we can, train him here as long as we can, and ship him out there and gallop him for a couple of days and run him.
Reeve, is there a difference between training a grass horse and a dirt horse, or do you just take the same approach and say, hey, a horse is a horse, we're going to train them the same way?
I think there's a slight difference. You know, I think, like my dad, he likes a lot, as long as they can train on the dirt, he wants to train them on the dirt. So as far as like breathing on the dirt or breathing on the grass, so ironic because he's done all his work on the dirt. He gets over the dirt well, and I kind of agree with that. I think if they can train on the dirt, it only helps them bigger and stronger. And so I think maybe there's little differences in the way you train them, but as long as they can stand up on the dirt and train on the dirt effectively, then I don't think you have to change too much. Now, some horses are a lot different where they don't handle the dirt, and then you kind of have to change your training a little bit to suit them a little better.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. That may be the first time in all the trainer talk programs we've done over the years that I've heard that particular take on it, that train horses on the dirt, whether they're a dirt horse or a turf horse. I don't remember hearing that before, Jude.
Yeah, well, it's a way that some people have done it. Laz Barrera used to tell me all the time, don't ever work horses on the turf for the, you know, like if you haven't run one on the turf, don't work one before you run it. Let them run on the turf, because his theory was in the morning, the turf course is different than it is in the afternoon, and it gets wet with dew and stuff, and sometimes it's slippery in the mornings, whereas if you just run them, you know, they'll be surprised, and they may win or they may not win, but at least they'll be able to get a hold of the course better, and you don't want to put them out there when it's when they've had that experience of slipping and sliding on a wet turf course in the morning. That was an interesting theory too.
Yeah, horses remember that kind of stuff, Reeve?
Yeah, I think that if they have a negative experience on something, then they remember it. Yeah, I think that would be pretty accurate.
Reeve,
maybe
McGahey,
they won't be quite as confident over it until they have a couple positive experiences on it.
He's trainer Reeve McGahey. He is the assistant trainer to Shug McGahey, and he is with us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Reeve, do trainers set goals?
Yeah, I think so. Not set in stone by any means, because so much changes on a daily basis, but obviously for Ironicus, our goal all year has been the Breeders' Cup Mile, and the year didn't go quite as we hoped it would. Obviously, we weren't planning on having a major gap between the Manhattan and the race at Keeneland, but he handled everything well, so we still have our main goal is still in sight, so we're excited about having that opportunity. So I think every horse at the beginning of the year, you kind of have an idea of what you'd like to accomplish, but I mean, it's not set in stone as to how you're going to get there, or you have a light plan and everything usually changes by halfway through the year.
So take me through that example of Ironicus. The goal, the year-end goal is the Breeders' Cup. You sit down at the beginning of the year. How do you go about mapping out that plan?
Well, we never really had we had an idea that we would like to run him in the Fort Marcy to start, but it was just going to be a matter of when he was ready, and luckily he got ready for it, and then he ran well there. And then we thought, well, maybe he'll be able to get the mile and a quarter, and there weren't a whole lot of other options. So the Manhattan became the main option then. And we would have liked to have been able to run in the four-star Dave in Saratoga, but that wasn't a possibility. So from there, I'm sure it would have been four-star Dave, to depending how he came out of the Bernard Baruch and then the Shadwell. But we missed those middle two races, but we still got to run the Shadwell. And I think it'll set us up pretty well for the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, he looks very tough on paper, and such a talented horse. It's not going to be an easy race, but he's certainly one of the best horses entered.
No, exactly. It's going to be it'll be difficult, but we're all pretty confident. So we'll just hope you get the right kind of trip and go from there.
Yeah, don't forget, you'll be able to hear the Breeders' Cup exclusively with us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. That coverage coming up November 4th and 5th, live from the Great Race Place in Arcadia, California. Visit horseracingradio.net for a complete Breeders' Cup week schedule. All of our Breeders' Cup coverage proudly presented by visitbarbados.org. Reeve, just a couple of minutes left before we have to wrap things up. Always like to end by asking trainers what other hobbies or interests that they might have outside of horse racing. How about for you?
I like to play golf. I used to like to play basketball, but I don't get as much opportunity now since I've been out of town. Other than that, I don't. I like, when I was home, I liked going to the UK basketball and football games. But so other than that, not too many hobbies. Watching the races, I guess, when I'm not participating in the races.
Are you a pretty good golfer?
I used to be able to play all right. Now I don't get to play nearly as often, so it's more frustrating than anything now.
How about a basketball player?
I was all right. I was a little small, but I always enjoyed playing.
Coach Kale never knocked on your door?
No, he forgot my number.
Well, Tyler Ulis wasn't real big.
Yeah, exactly.
How about your favorite UK player? Do you have one?
Yeah, I mean, I was a big Tyler Ulis fan, but I don't know, there have been a few through the years. I like the Marcus Cousins. When I was younger, Jody Meeks, guys like that, Tayshaun Prince.
Will you continue to follow them when they get drafted and they start playing in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, I pay attention to how they're doing it. I'm not watching their games every night or anything, but I'll check to see. If they're on TV, I'll watch for a little while.
Well, Reeve McGahey, not taking the basketball route, not taking the golf route. He's taken the horse racing route, and it's served him pretty well so far in his very young career. And, Reeve, we want to thank you for being with us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Want to wish you all the best moving forward, and please say hello to your dad for us when you get a chance to see him.
All right, I will. Thank you for having me.
All right, Trainer Reeve McGahey with us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. And, you know, some interesting things coming out of that conversation with Reeve. One in particular was that little tidbit that he threw out there a little while ago about his dad training turf horses and dirt horses and training them all on the dirt. It doesn't matter. That's his approach. Maybe one of the little secrets of the McGahey barn and one of the reasons he's been so successful.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach. But the one thing you have to remember is you can't, at least when you're at the racetrack, gallop horses on the turf every day. So you kind of have to use the main track. And, you know, you have horses that you certainly maybe don't want to breeze on the main track, but they have to gallop out there and jog by and large.
You ever get tempted when a horse is working well in the dirt, a turf horse, and say, man, we need to go to the dirt races and not the turf races?
Well, that's I was going to ask him that question, but yeah. I figured with the Breeders' Cup coming up, I'd leave it alone. But yeah, Ironicus on the dirt, like, you know, he could probably give Dortmund a run in the dirt mile.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
No, great stuff. Again, check out that full Breeders' Cup week schedule on our website, horseracingradio.net, and a podcast of this program right there for you on our website, horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for our special guest, Reeve McGahey, and for the pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.